You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. What do Swatara, Shikellamy, Kinzew Bridge, and Tuscarora State Parks all have in common, besides being state parks in Pennsylvania? They are all named after Native American villages that were located in the state. In fact, half of the 141 state parks and forests in Pennsylvania include Native names and places. Many parks grew out of paths that American Indians used for centuries before European colonists arrived 400 years ago. On today's program, we'll talk about that history. Joining us, Angie Jollett-Wentling, a Cultural Resources Program Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, the Bureau of State Parks, and Ashley Berry, a park ranger who is working at the Laurel Ridge State Park Complex. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So, Angie, let me start with you. How did so many state parks and forests get Native names?
I think it was a result of when we were originally naming the state park system. It dates to the early 20th century. And so at that time, natives were a lot closer to the public. And so I think a lot of them picked place names that were close to the parks or, trails, waterways, things like that, all things of importance to natives and to modern populations.
So, and I know that not everyone, one of these followed the same path, if you will, but the colonists who used these same paths that the Native Americans did they learn the Native names and maybe kept them in some cases?
Yeah, I think a lot of times they learned them, they mispronounced them, they miswrote them, a lot like we do today. So a lot of times you'll see maybe five different versions of a name for a waterway or a trail path. I think that, and a lot of times, different peoples had different names for those resources. So you'll get a lot of different options when you see like early colonists and early traders and explorers and folks like that that are going out into and interacting with these peoples. They come back with different names for different things.
Well, give me an example of one when you said that there are some that are mispronounced or misspelled maybe five different ways. Give me an example of one that Pennsylvanians would be familiar with that is often mispronounced or misspelled.
Actually, just one that's real close to me, and I think Ashley, too, is the Yakagani. That's a tough word for anybody to say now, but I think if you look in the historic documents, you see a lot of different misspellings and mispronunciations or just different versions. A lot of times they're going off the sound of a name as opposed to how it's written in our language. We don't have all the same letters, and so a lot of times you're trying to make the same sounds with different letters. But throughout the years, there are all kinds of different spellings from the one we have now, which as opposed to other ones that are closer to like Yohoho, Igahini, things like that. Also, the name Ohiophile has had multiple versions throughout the years.
Okay, say that again, because I'm going to try to learn how to say it by the end of the program. Say that again.
So the Yakagani is how we pronounce the river that runs through Ohiophile now.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of people just shorten it to the Yak.
Okay, they shorten it to the Yak. But what was the pronunciation that you said that the Native American pronunciation?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if it's going to be good, but I think it's some of the spellings were like Y-O-H-O. And Gahanee, so Yohogani, and that's probably a terrible mispronunciation.
Do we have, are there natives, are there people, ancestors of that tribe, maybe still members of that tribe, living in Pennsylvania or outside of Pennsylvania, who could provide the correct pronunciation of what their ancestors called that river?
I'm positive there are you know, Pennsylvania has a pretty rough past in terms of like colonization efforts and pushing Native peoples out of Pennsylvania on a large scale. But we still obviously have a lot of Native folks that are still living in Pennsylvania's boundaries today. Some of the places I like to go to are, you know, websites like nativelands.ca, where you can find a map of the different cultures that were in the region that you're living in today. Penn State's library just put out an Indigenous Peoples Guide to resources like maps and other things. A number of Native tribes have actually sponsored translators. So like word translators, you can put in, a English name now, and you can put it into their system and they can possibly tell you where it derived from, things like different resources like that. But like for the people, you know, we work a lot with federally recognized tribes and nations. So a lot of times we'll reach out to our counterparts there, the Tribal Historic Preservation Offices. Those are the folks that a lot of times are cultural keepers of their different culture practices, things like that. And they'll be the ones who can really put you in touch with someone that, like the different elders and faith keepers that would be able to help you with that.
Now, you said you work with these federally recognized tribes. When you say you work, I'm assuming you're talking about the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. In what ways do you work with these tribes?
Well, we're starting to do it on a more systematic and programmatic basis in Pennsylvania's DCNR. But mainly what we're trying to do right now is to begin and work towards consultation with those federally recognized tribes and nations. So off the top of my head in Pennsylvania, I think we have about 12 to 15 different federally recognized tribes and nations. So those are a lot of folks to speak with. But what we're trying to do is to make sure that we're incorporating their concerns, their input into our planning processes at the state level. But you'll see it also in the parks. Actually, going back to Ohio Pile, there are certainly efforts at the local level to incorporate Indigenous folks and their name, their life ways and things like that in our interpretation efforts.
Is that because there's a thirst or a hunger for history of these tribes, of these Native Americans in Pennsylvania?
I think so, but I'm a very biased audience. I think Ashley, with her role in the parks, she's in a lot of interaction with, you know, people at the local level, you know, people that visit our parks. And I think she could probably speak to that a lot better than I can.
Okay, Ashley Barry, you are a park ranger working at Laurel Ridge State Park, and I'm going to ask you in a moment what Glades Path is and Raystown Path. But to just follow up on what Angie was saying, you work with a lot of the ancestors or the tribes, even today?
Not necessarily the ancestors and tribes, but I do work a lot with the locals in the area. And I have noticed a very increased amount of interest in our past. You know, people are truly interested in connecting with their ancestors and their past peoples. So yeah, there's a lot of interest there.
Well, when you say they're interested in their past, are you talking about Native American past or somehow the past of people who ancestors of European colonists and how they interacted with the American Indians?
I think definitely both. You know, we have a lot of connection with both our, you know, Native American past within. I work within a park complex. We have three parks. Couser State Park and Laurel Ridge State Park have a lot of Native American history. And I think a lot of folks are interested in connecting with that past. But also at Laurel Hill State Park, we have a lot of kind of that European American culture, and folks are also interested in connecting with that. So I think there's an even amount of interest in connecting with both Native American and European cultures.
When you talk about Laurel Ridge, for example, and you said that there's a lot of Native American history, how do you know? What kind of history have you found?
So looking at some of these Native paths that run or intersect with the Laurel Highlands Hiking Trail in Laurel Ridge State Park, we have Glades Path, which intersects right around mile marker 33. It kind of intersects right where the Northwoods Trail loops around in the Forbes State Forest. So, you know, knowing that that trail, the Native Glades Path, runs through a portion of our park, you know, there was a lot of Native American movement. You know, folks or Native Americans moved, they traversed this trail back and forth, trading things like goods and services and ideas and knowledge of other cultures. And then there's also the Raystown Path that runs through Laurel Ridge State Park and intersects with the Laurel Highlands Hiking Trail. So those are just a couple of examples of the Native American history that runs through Laurel Ridge.
Now, you talked about what the paths were used for. I mean, that sounds like what we could describe modern transportation systems like today. But who were the Native Americans that were trading goods and services and news and that kind of thing? Was this between tribes or amongst just different villages or what?
It was both. So it was amongst, you know, more local tribes that kind of traveled through the area. And it was also within tribes that spanned, you know, across the country. There are certain resources that are in other areas of the country that we do not have and have not ever had here. Things like obsidian, that was a very, you know, hot commodity to trade. So Native Americans would kind of traverse these trails and meet with other Native American tribes and groups and trade these resources, things like obsidian or maple sugar, for instance. We have some of the best maple sugar in the country in this area. So Native Americans would often trade those types of resources along these paths.
Obsidian, what is that?
It is volcanic rock.
Oh,
we do not have volcanoes here in Pennsylvania, so definitely something that it was used to make things like arrowheads and tips.
Okay, so that kind of explains why when you can see so many arrowheads that have been recovered today that look like volcanic rock.
Absolutely.
Huh. Kit has a question, wants to know if you could describe the landscape of the old Native American trails and their effect on today's location of towns and cities in Pennsylvania. In other words, did not only did state parks and forests grow out of these Native American paths and villages, but he's asking if towns and cities in Pennsylvania did as well. Angie, is that something you can answer?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I think when I first started looking at history, you know, everybody looks at, you know, the old world history. You know, like you look out east, you look at Petra and you look at Egypt. But a lot of our landscapes here in Pennsylvania are very similar in the fact that, you know, people privilege the same places over and over again for the same reasons, you know, proximity to waterways, different resources, natural resources, things that they're trading, advantages on the landscape. And so you see people populate the same places over and over and over again. So places like in Pittsburgh, the points there, where Point State Park sits today, you know, we have over 5,000 years of occupation just in that one point. Also places like Philadelphia, you know, we have layer upon layer of people living from pre-contact times into the historic period, which just kind of gets at the, you know, the fact that for different reasons, people will still tend towards the same areas of occupation.
So, you know, even though it wasn't just European colonists who said, oh, here's a good place to start a city or a town, you know, the Native Americans had the same thoughts of why many of these areas were great to have villages on. You know, I find this very interesting, though. What you've done is you've created a list of the 141 state parks and forests and some of the names that have derived from Native Americans. And so many of them are just so interesting. I mean, in our area here in central Pennsylvania, Cadore State Park, meaning rapid water. Now, there's one that just, I think you can assume, you know why Cadore State Park got the name Rapid Water. Someone in a Native American tribe said, there's rapid water there, and this is what we're going to call it. Susquehanna River, Long Reach River. So these are just a couple examples of Indian names, but you have all kinds of them. Are there some that maybe would really surprise people, or that they would find really interesting, that those translations into what, you know, from English into English names into Native American language? I don't know. And Ashley, is that something you could take?
Honestly, I think Angie might be able to speak a little bit better to that, given her background.
Actually, Ohio is my favorite. It's for a couple of different reasons. The Youghiogheny, like that roughly translates to water that turns back upon itself. For those of you that don't know, the Youghiogheny actually flows in reverse. So it flows from south to north as opposed to north to south. So that was one that I always really liked. It's also a very circuitous river. So there are lots of twists and bends. So I always thought that that was a really wonderful way to describe it. And then Ohio Pile itself, that translates to white frothy water. And if you've ever seen pictures of Ohio Pile or spent much time in that region, the Youghiogheny in that area is very white and frothy because of the waterfalls that are pretty famous in that region.
Then on the other hand, Angie, you have Evansburg State Park. You have the Perkiomen Path in Evansburg State Park. But then you have the Skipback Creek, which translates to pool of stagnant offensive water, wetland. That doesn't sound exactly like a state park I'd like to go to if you have a pool of stagnant offensive water.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's funny because that gets a lot at people's perceptions of wetlands, right? Whereas even though those might be marginal lands and they might be wet predominantly part of the year, you know, that's good to know if you're traveling through. It's also kind of like the Walmart of resources, I think, in pre-contact times. You know, we don't see people necessarily living in wetland conditions, but we do see them going there because of the wealth of resources that are there. The plants, the animals that go and spend time in wetlands would have made it a very, you know, good place to stop off.
Well,
it makes sense that there would be a trail into that area.
Well, Angie, you don't have to apologize for it. The natives named it, not you. So we'll just say that. Let's take a phone call from Robert in Fayetteville. Robert, you're on Smart Talk.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I was very interested in several of your programs, but we live here on the edge of the Cumberland Valley, which main drainage system is the Conococheague Creek, and Caledonia Park, which obviously isn't a native name, has the headwaters of the Conococheague, which flows through our property. And we are having an international meeting in Gettysburg at the end of April and May, and we're honoring a Dr. William Bender, who has became an internationally known daffodil hybridizer and named many of his daffodils after Native Americans and place names in the area, like Tuscarora and Sikilome. And Sikilome was a Native American leader who his own ancestor, Conrad Weiser, had a lot of dealings with, and the Weiser you know, park is not is their homestead is easily accessible. I want to know how I can find out what language was spoken and what tribes were habitating my property, because we're going to have a garden party here.
Well, you know, and Robert, you anticipate one of the questions I have, because I'm sure we are going to have a lot of people who want to know more. So, Angie, to Robert's question, how can he and how can others learn more about the history of these Native Americans in Pennsylvania?
So I would start with some of the mapping resources that are out there. There's a really great website called native-land.ca. If you go there, you can actually look through, and it'll show you the layers of occupation. So, you know, we know a lot of the Native Americans, not only were they living in Pennsylvania ancestrally, but they may have also moved through Pennsylvania as they're being pushed out of their ancestral lands. So we have, you know, multiple layers of occupation throughout Pennsylvania. So that one's a really great resource. Another really great resource is Penn State just put out a library of different indigenous resources to include maps, a guide to land acknowledgments, treaties, languages, things like, for different resources for Native American culture. Another, I always like to reach out to the folks at tribal historic preservation offices at some of the Native lands that we have, like the Seneca Nation or the Delaware Tribe, the Delaware Nation of Indians, the Shawnee. We have a number of different representative tribes that we work with that may not currently be seated in Pennsylvania, but certainly were here ancestrally. So I always kind of look for it. You know, you start with the map, get an idea of where you think or who you think were here, and then you can reach out to those folks individually. And also museums and resources that are on Native lands. Those are a great place where, you know, people and artifacts are stashed there with a lot of that cultural knowledge that you're looking for.
Hey, Robert, thank you very much for your call. And just a couple books that I know that you could purchase at the State Museum and through the Pennsylvania Historical Museum Commission's office. Dr. Paul Wallace's Indian Paths of Pennsylvania. Now, this was a book that was first published in 1965. Dr. George Donahue's Indian Villages and Place Names in Pennsylvania with Numerous Historical Notes and References. Now, this book was first published in 1928. But it was reprinted again in 2014. So though there are a couple resources for you as well. Let's take another phone call from David in Lancaster. David, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if there are any trail trees still standing in Pennsylvania.
Trail trees, meaning what's
The Native Americans would intentionally shape trees to indicate where there was water or hunting grounds. There's still some standing out in the Midwest. I was wondering if there are any still standing in Pennsylvania.
Andy, Angie or Ashley?
I have not seen any verified, but I think that that's an interest on the part of both, you know, European Americans and Native Americans, that if there are resources like that out there, I think that that's something, you know, they're interested in learning, and they are probably more likely than I would be to know if there were ones like that. But yeah, the marker trees. I think I understand what you're talking about there. Ashley, I don't know if you know of any.
I do not. I am not aware of any myself. But as you had mentioned, I think that there is certainly a growing interest in exploring and kind of discovering some of that, some of the vestiges, for sure.
Hey, thank you very much for your call, David. But you know, David brings up a point. What are some of the relics or some of the things that we can see in Pennsylvania state parks or forests that were created or left behind by the Native Americans?
I think it's really interesting to think about how people have change the landscape. And unfortunately, because of our topography, but also because of industrialization and some of the different, the mass cutting of our trees and things like that, that we've lost a lot. So a lot of what we know about our resources and the state parks, we've lost a great deal, but I think you can still see it in some areas. Like, we know that Native Americans were slash and burn. They were basically modifying the forest for their hunting and resource extraction, things like that. So they would burn patches of the forest. I think you can catch glimpses of that much in the same way that we do now. If you've ever kind of stumbled onto a clearer portion of the forest that has edge area for the animals, you may be looking at something like that. I think too, that's part of the bonus of archaeology, right? Like, I'm an archaeologist by training, so I'm biased here, but part of what archaeology does is dig into the areas that we have that may not be on the surface, right? So you can get at that story that's kind of left untold, that's in the soils, or you can recreate, the land and the environment in which Native American peoples were living, and really get at how they were modifying not only the landscape, but other things in their world.
But there are no places in state parks or forests where you can point to and say, "Oh, here, were drawings or places where we could see where a village was located."
Oh, sorry, there are plenty. There are plenty. Unfortunately, most archaeological sites tend to look like a grassy field, or they look like a pile of rocks sometimes. But I think there are a number of places, like petroglyphs you've mentioned. I don't know off the top of my head if we have any in state parks. I'm sure we do in state forests or along waterways. A lot of times the petroglyphs along waterways, or sometimes you'll see them in rock shelters. But I usually, for me, it's you, especially with the paths, you can really kind of see how they're using the different landforms. In the east, they're preferencing areas along the wider waterways. In the west, you see them more along the ridge tops, the areas that were a little more traversable. But I always kind of imagine it that way more so.
Well, like I said, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who today, or maybe even over the holidays, are going to be looking into Native American past here in Pennsylvania. Angie Jalet-Wentling, a Cultural Resources Program Coordinator with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation Natural Resources Bureau of State Parks, and Ashley Barry, a park ranger working at the Laurel Ridge State Park Complex. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.